This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. All over the country today, kids are sharpening their pencils and charging up their laptops. The first day of school is usually an optimistic moment, but it can be confusing, too, and not just for the children. Each year, critics emerge to denounce the state of public education in America and to propose remedies: lower class size, less homework or more, and more testing or less. Today, we begin a weekly series on public education with two very different takes on schooling and education. A bit later in the program, Edward Humes joins us to talk about his new book, School of Dreams, about a year at one of the best public high schools in the country. And in a moment, John Taylor Gatto's provocative argument that public education is designed to dumb down and demoralize our kids. We'll also hear about a school district in Mississippi that's installed webcams to watch every classroom, and we want to hear from you. What is the purpose of public education? Beyond the basics, what should the goals be? Are the most serious problems philosophical or financial? Come with us back to school and tell us, what did you learn and where did you learn it? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. John Taylor Gatto is a former New York State and New York City Teacher of the Year. He's the author of several books, including The Underground History of American Education. He wrote the lead essay in the upcoming September issue of Harper's Magazine called Against Schools. John Taylor Gatto joins us now from the campus of Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. A pleasure to be with you.
In your article, you claim, as do many people, that kids and teachers are bored by school, that school is boring, and yet, indeed, you say that in some ways that's its purpose.
Well, it's meant to be boring. I've spent the last 12 years trying to find out why the schools I worked in operated as they did. I was politically neutral about this and curious to discover how an institution I spent my life in worked at such cross purposes to how kids actually learn. And in the course of doing that, I discovered the fourth purpose of schooling, which is never discussed publicly.
And what is that fourth purpose?
Well, let me tell you what the first three purposes are, because every one of your listeners will agree with one or all of those. The original purpose of sending your kid into schooling with strangers, which is hundreds and hundreds of years old, if not thousands, was to make them good people. You could call that the religious purpose, although it can be affected in a secular fashion. The second purpose, which comes about during the French Revolution, is to make them good citizens. That does not mean obedient, well-behaved people. It means people who can argue effectively in the public forum. And the third purpose, which comes about only in very wealthy countries, is to make people their personal best. That's the private purpose. So everywhere I've traveled in the world in the last 12 years, and I've gone 2 million miles, everyone will agree with one or two or all of those purposes, the religious, the public, and the private. But in the beginning of the 19th century, in the North German state of Prussia, a fourth purpose emerged for schooling, and that was to make management, both public and private, more efficient. Efficiency is the operant term here, so that children are looked upon as human resources to be conditioned in such a way that they can be efficiently managed. I want to remove the sinister part of this. This is probably the ultimate product of rationalism. And the fourth purpose says kids are human resources. We need to make the economy and the government efficient, and we do this by allowing children to remain in an incomplete state. And of course, that's differential. Some kids you bring closer to completion, and some very few you attempt to complete entirely. The elite private boarding schools are the clue to how that's done.
Well, that's not necessarily to train the children probably of the wealthy more than the elite.
Well, it's become both. But it originated in the 19th century largely. Right up until to the middle of the 19th century, we had basically six private boarding schools in the country, and they were kind of catch-as-catch-can. They depended on some personal philosophy. But after Darwin wrote Descent of Man in 1871, the buzz all over the drawing rooms of New England and New York and Berlin and London was how to prevent people who were biologically, let me say, challenged, which was about 95% of the human race, from overwhelming those people who are evolutionarily advanced. And the way to do this was by differentially schooling them. Some people would be taught to be problem solvers, and some people would be taught to be the masters of the problem solvers, people who can think in context. What's wrong with problem solving is as close to universal memory as DDT. The problem was to kill bugs, and it was successfully solved by problem solvers.
You've been making this argument and one similar to it, I guess, since you rather publicly resigned from your job as a teacher in the New York City public school system back in 1991. You wrote an op-ed article in the Wall Street Journal and denounced the state of education, and obviously you're continuing the criticism in this article in Harper's Magazine. Yet there are an awful lot of people who are very smart people and very dedicated people and very idealistic people who also work in the school system, in the public schools around this country, and dedicate their lives to try to, they think, help educate the kids who are coming along.
I admire a large segment of the teaching fraternity. They truly sacrifice a great deal in the interests of total strangers. But in fact, the layers of management above those people, which are in a manner of speaking, almost infinite. Nobody knows where school policy comes from. It passes down through these stages until it reaches the classroom teacher. And any classroom teacher listening knows they're given virtually no sovereignty in the classroom except to reproduce what they're told to communicate.
So yet they think they're there for a purpose, and they've helped inspire.
It's a lovely ideal. And it works, oddly enough, because a certain segment of the teaching population, probably without thinking much about it, actively sabotages what their job description is. They do this in a whole variety of humanistic ways, but that's far from the totality. And in the New York City schools and in all large city schools that I've seen, effectively, that's a way to call attention to yourself and receive brutal treatment from school administrations.
Our guest is John Taylor Gatto. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're discussing what public education is for. And joining us now on the line is Mike, who's with us from Spokane, Washington.
Yeah, I just want to concur with what Mr. Gatto is saying. I'm going to school right now to be a teacher, and I went to school in Anaheim High School in Anaheim, California. And basically, I think a lot of what I learned was independent reading, finding out things on my own. I don't think the education system really wants a lot of smart people, because the way the economy is set up, you don't want smart people working at Walmart or McDonald's or whatever. You don't want them actually thinking about things. You want them to be able to do a certain job a certain way, and it's I don't know what else to say about that, but
Yet, Mike, you say you're going to school now to study to be a teacher?
Yes, I am.
So you're going to be part of this system?
I am going to be part of this system. I hope that there's going to be some change along the way, and I hope I'll be able to do some good. But I do agree with what Mr. Gatto was saying. I'm conflicted about it, to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead, Mr. Gatto.
Mike, what you've happened upon is a necessary closing of the circle. The type of schooling we do has to depend on the type of economy that we have. And I have a list here of the 9 leading jobs in our economy. This comes from the Department of Labor. I think it'll be an eye-opener. Number 1 is a clerk at Walmart, a retail salesperson. Number 2 is a nurse. Number 3, a cashier. Number 4, an office clerk. Number 5, a truck driver. Number 6, a janitor or a domestic servant. Number 7, a nurse's aide, an orderly, or an attendant. Number 9, a food counter and related worker. And number 10, a waiter or a waitress. You can't manage a workforce that's composed of those job categories. You can't manage it without a lot of static if, in fact, people are educated. So they have to be schooled or conditioned to accept pretty much their subordinate position in the economy. This doesn't happen through natural selection. It happens from design. And the design is very, very easy to find if you go back to 1890 to 1910, when the people who were doing the designing were boasting about bringing order to the society and efficiency to the economy.
Mike, what are you going to do to make it better?
Basically, I read Mr. Gato's article, and I was fascinated by it because I agree somewhat. But I'm basically calling to ask him what would he suggest as a way to get through all the, because, I mean, the education, like any government entity, is very, you know, bureaucratic in nature. But how can we do something to change this?
I would be glad to be specific because I spent half of my teaching career doing that and doing it successfully enough that the management named me New York State Teacher of the Year and 3 times New York City Teacher of the Year because they didn't understand what, in fact, I was doing in the classroom. But I'd like to pitch this as if it were parents rather than teachers, and you can easily adapt this to your own practice, Mike. School trains children to be employees and to be consumers. So you want to teach your own to be leaders and adventurers. Now, you might not know how to teach a leader, but let me tell you that Exeter and Andover and St. Paul's and Groton absolutely do, and it's child's play simply to adapt their practices to your public school classroom. School trains children to obey reflexively, not to argue dialectically. So you have to teach your own to think critically and independently, which doesn't make your classroom experience, makes it very lively, very exciting, but it does not make it easier. Well-schooled kids have a very low threshold of boredom, so you need to help your own kids understand where boredom comes from. It's if you don't have an inner life, an active inner life, you depend upon the people that you impinge upon to entertain you, to amuse you. Now, where does an active inner life come from? Well, the elite private boarding schools know it comes from using grown-up material in history and literature and philosophy and music and art and economics and in theology. And by the way, almost all of the elite private boarding schools have a strong theological core. They have lessons in religion, and they have religious services. St. Paul's and Groton, which are probably the class of the class, are religious schools.
Mike, thanks very much for the call, and good luck with your career in teaching.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more with John Taylor Gatto after a short break as we continue to discuss the purpose of public education. We'll also be talking with Edward Humes about his new book, School of Dreams, Making the Grade at a Top American High School. We'll also take more of your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the role public schools play in the education of our children. Would you say you got your education at school or somewhere else? Our guest is John Taylor Gatto. His article in the current issue of Harper's Magazine is called Against School, How Public Education Cripples Our Kids and Why. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's get another caller up, and Gus joins us on the line from Burbank, California.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. My sense of the purpose of public education is to develop thoughtful, well-educated, concerned, involved citizens. It's citizens that we're trying to build. And at least in my opinion, we're heading into this new millennium where we have a terrific opportunity to steer our democracy into new territory aside from where it's been. We need to let go of the past and get on with the new. I had an extremely fortunate education in the public schools, good old Burbank Unified School District. And most of all, what I was taught was to learn how to learn. I was inspired and motivated to learn how to learn, and I've never stopped ever since.
Well, Mr. Gatto, that would be contrary to your experience in New York City.
No, it wouldn't. As a matter of fact, I would agree with Gus, and my own favorite purpose for schooling is to make good citizens. Now, let me tell you where the contradiction was in what you said, Mike. You cannot be a good citizen unless you can argue effectively in the marketplace of ideas. To do that, you have to be skilled at a whole variety of public speakings and a whole variety of writing, short essays, memos, and so on. What schools will acknowledge that they have no time or resources, they claim mistakenly, to teach are public speaking and writing. I made those two items the center of my curriculum, and inside of 40 days I had no discipline problems with classes full of Harlem students who I was told were unmanageable and unteachable.
I would agree with you completely.
Well, Gus, congratulations on your education. What are you using it for?
Oh my goodness. Well, I've had 30 some years in high tech, although I'm about to turn the corner and go teach myself.
Really? Where?
Well, somewhere in California, if ever teachers get hired again.
Oh, there will be a day.
I trust.
Good luck, Gus.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. And John Taylor Gatto, I wanted to thank you for being with us today.
This is a pleasure. You guys have been my inspiration for 30 years.
Well, thank you very much for that. John Taylor Gatto is a former New York City school teacher, the author of many books, including The Underground History of American Education. His essay, Against Schools, appears in the September issue of Harper's Magazine, and he was with us from the campus of Cornell University. And joining us now is Edward Humes. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the author of numerous books, including Baby ER. His new book is School of Dreams, Making the Grade at a Top American High School. It looks at Whitney High in Cerritos, California. He joins us from the studios of K-Jazz in Long Beach, California. And welcome to the program.
Thanks, Neil. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. You spent a year at Whitney High in School of Dreams. Was the book your initial motivation to go there?
Well, yeah, I'd say so, although I have to confess high school the second time around when I wasn't a teenager was a lot more enjoyable.
There have been movies about that, finally going back and getting it right as an adult. But one of the things we're talking about today is what public education is for. And I think we have to begin by describing this particular school as among the most extraordinary in the country in terms of public schools on a level with Stuyvesant High or Boston Latin.
Yeah, Whitney High School is really a pretty remarkable story because it started out as the kind of school Mr. Gatto is referring to, a largely failed program that was about to close. And rather than having a program dictated from on high, the principal and teachers got together and came up with a new idea for an academic magnet school that they sort of fashioned around the kitchen table and attracted some students to the school, made academics the priority over all else, you know, everything from driving privileges to sports teams, you name it, got parents to buy into that idea and really built this place from the ground up with a very low budget, very humble facilities. And for the last 10 years or so, they've been the top ranked school in California.
And this is a school where there are advertisements you write in South Korean newspapers for real estate in Cerritos, California, based on the idea that it is in the same district as Whitney High School.
Exactly. Well, the school has really remade the demographics of its community, because can you imagine, here's a public school that people move from around the world to attend, or to at least try to attend. And the curious thing is that in its own neighborhood and in the state of California, it's virtually unheard of. It's anonymous. And I think that really goes to the emphasis we have now on talking about failure in public schools. I think success in public schools, which is rather underreported.
What's its mission? What is it designed to do?
Well, it's designed to do some of the things that you've been talking about today, which is to create kids who are great learners, as opposed to another trend we see a lot in schools now is becoming great test takers. The school kind of is fighting that balancing act all the time, trying to fulfill all the mandates for various tests that the state and the federal government impose, and still have time to do the sorts of in-depth learning that they really want to present to the kids as an opportunity. The school's mission, though, is really to get their kids into top colleges around the country, and to sort of prepare them for the arms race of college admissions that they might face.
Anyone who spends time at Whitney, you write, can see it delivers everything we could ask of a public school: hard work, dedication, academic excellence, a sense of mission all too lacking in other schools, a love of learning, a commitment to civic involvement, a safe haven, and last but not least, in this era of accountability and school budgets linked to performance, test scores to die for. But also on display, you write, are the unintended consequences of building the public high school of our dreams, the creation of a new generation of high-achieving, highly pressured young people who fall in despair not from failing a course, but from getting a B.
Yes, that was it was a pretty amazing environment to be in, to see kids who are routinely getting by on a few hours sleep, or who are carrying loads of work and study that would stagger many a corporate CEO, I think. And at the same time, the even greater surprise is to sit down with these same kids and have them talk about how much they love this school that's working them so hard. So it was really a mixed bag. They're stressed out, and yet they can't imagine being anyplace else, which is pretty amazing.
We're talking about the purpose of high school education, public high school education. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address totn@npr.org. And let's get a call from Peter, who's with us from St. Paul.
Hi, I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota. I just graduated from high school this summer. I'm going on to college. I wanted to say that the best things I got out of high school, I got from really good teachers. I had one particularly at the end of grade school who, she said I was smart, so she'd have me write two papers instead of one. And then when I got into high school, I got in the IB program, and just using adult material, I think, really helps with classes. And I think if they had more curriculum designed similar to college curriculum, that we'd see a lot more thinking people come out of school.
Where are you off to college, Peter?
I'm going to Gustavus.
I'm not sure where that is.
I'm going to Gustavus. It's in St. Peter. It's southern Minnesota.
Well, good luck to you. And you feel ready for it after difficult high school education?
To be honest, sometimes it was pretty easy, but towards the last 2 years, they actually gave us hard reading, like maybe 50 or 75 pages a night. One other thing I wanted to say is that I got almost nothing out of computers.
Mm-hmm.
But and I don't know how much of an issue this is, but I think there's a lot of waste going into like trying to teach technology, or trying to modernize schools and put them on Ethernet or whatever. I think stick to the basics, basic computer instruction and like how to navigate operating systems or just typing would be good. But I think most people learn that on their own.
Good luck to you, Peter.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks for the call.
Yep.
Edward Humes, 50, 60 pages a night, that would be a modest appetizer for a lot of the kids at Whitney.
Yeah. they would probably have to spend considerable more time most nights, although it varies. One of the interesting things about the kids at Whitney was the expectations that were held out for them by their parents and their teachers for the amount of work they would be able to handle. And that was something that was both the school's strength and maybe sometimes the bane of the kids' existence, that there was this extremely high set of expectations held out for them all.
Let's get another caller on the line, and Ford joins us from Dearborn, Michigan.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
My question was this. I'm 51 years old. When I went to school, I noticed a lack of this, and I wondered if these some of these new higher-achieving schools cover the subject of just basic life skills like buying a house, what a mortgage is. When I look back, I'm just astonished at how little information I got on that and how really important it is to live your life successfully.
Is that an element at Whitney High, Ed Humes?
Well, I think so, although there's a certain amount of a cocoon-like nature to this very intense academic environment. And although I think it prepares them well for moving on to college academically, they may not have all those practical skills. So I'm not sure that this school is any different than any other high school in that regard.
Okay. Ford, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. As you say, the goal at Whitney, which is unusual for a public high school, is to send all of its graduates onto college. And how well does it do that?
It pretty much does it. I think it's 99% successful on that score. And many of the students there are trying to get into some of the more elite schools, and they do pretty well in that respect. But, you know, you're talking about kids. It's a high school. It's a generation of high-achieving students that seems to me very different than past ones. I mean, these are kids that will get a 1,500 on their SATs, which puts them in the top 5% of the country, and they'll take it again. They'll get their parents to pay $1,000 to send them to an academy to try and get an extra 50 or 60 points because they think that's what they're going to need to get an edge in order to get into an Ivy League school or something comparable to that. And that's the kids I went to school with would just as soon, you know, kill themselves than take the SAT twice. So it's a new experience.
Your picture doesn't show you as being all that old, and yet it sounds as if the experience is just night and day difference from when you went to school.
Well, I think it is, and I don't think that parents today really fully understand what the lives of these high achievers, or maybe any high school students, are really like. I mean, it was a unique opportunity for me to get into this school and to be the only adult on the premises that wasn't grading them, judging them, or bossing them around. You know, I had the opportunity just to sit in class with them every day, and some of the teachers actually said, if you're going to take up space, you're going to have to do the work. So I did that and really got to know these pretty remarkable kids and the lives they lead in a way that I hope is instructive, because they'll be the first ones to tell you that their parents don't have a clue what it's really like for them and how hard they're working.
Our guest is Edward Humes. His new book is School of Dreams, Making the Grade at a Top American High School. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go now to Jenny, who joins us from Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
Hi.
Hi.
My comment is that I was, you know, schooled in a small town in Wisconsin, and the people that went to our school basically got jobs as soon as they turned 16. And as a result, it really seemed like all the kids in our high school weren't encouraged to really immerse themselves in study and learn everything they could, because, you know, 90% of the kids didn't really care. They had to go to work after school. And those of us who questioned and those of us who really wanted to get involved, you know, teachers kind of looked at us like, you know, what's wrong with you? You know? And we didn't have the opportunity because it's as if our teachers just kind of succumbed to the kids going, yeah, we don't care, we have other things to do.
Hmm. And so a school like Whitney must seem like the other side of the planet.
Oh, it seems like a luxury, really. It seems like, you know, an awesome place to go to school where you're encouraged to spend time on it. I grew up in an environment where we were raised not to ask questions and just kind of follow the flow and grow up and have a job. And that's it. You know, we weren't raised to be thinking citizens. We weren't raised to be citizens. We were raised to be drones, essentially.
Okay, Jenny, thanks very much.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Here's an email from Bob Ungs. Whitney High School is hardly anonymous in its own backyard, he writes. The problem is that not just everyone is eligible to attend. It hardly seems a big surprise they produce test scores to die for when the criteria for entry in the first place is that students provide evidence of having previously scored at that level. Don't get me wrong, it's a great program, but hardly a model that can be duplicated in other schools which accept all students who reside in their attendance boundaries. Ed Hume?
Well, it's true that this school over time has been able to attract and now requires a certain level of achievement from the kids who go there. And that's how the program was designed. When it first started and first started to excel, it pretty much took anyone who would come. But yes, your caller is absolutely right. It serves the entire school district, and students are invited to attend from all the various elementary and middle school areas. So there is an admission requirement, and it would be shocking if they did not do well. The thing about the students at Whitney is that it's still a very diverse group because the different schools in the district are operating in a considerably broad spectrum of achievement, and they're taking about 20% from all of those schools. So it's a little broader than the caller suggesting, but it's true. The other thing about them is that the performance of the students once they get to Whitney, when compared to other college track students at other schools around the country, and it's essentially a high school of all college-bound students, their performance on things like the AP tests, the advanced placement tests that are very much in demand as far as getting into
top colleges,
yeah, these days. Their performance on these tests seems to be markedly better than comparable students at other schools. So there's also something going on at this school and with this program that seems to be making a difference. And it seemed to me that it was very obvious what that was, and it's what we've already talked about, that academics is the top priority of these kids. Their parents buy into it totally. They spend a lot more time and energy on their kids' education than the average household does, and that's something I've looked at in the book. And the result is that the kids do better. It's really kind of common sense.
We're going to continue talking about education and the purpose of public education when we come back from a short break. If you'd like to join the discussion, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@npr.org. We'll wrap up our discussion with Edward Humes, the author of School of Dreams, and we'll talk about a school district in Mississippi that's installed webcams to monitor every hallway and every classroom. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.